Welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. Tonight we'll be hearing readings of poetry from Mari Carter and Alex Quinlan.
And there's just a couple of reminders for you. Please don't smoke in the warehouse. And also, please don't get up in the middle. We'll have a little break. So if you need a break, we'll have a break between the readings. And also, please silence your cell phones. Thanks.
So up first to introduce Mari Carter is Jamie Ringleb.
Hello. I'm just going to dive into this. So many poets try to come across in their poems as faultless people, which is, if not violently boring, irreparably douchey. Mostly because the term faultless belongs to no one. And if we suspect that it may apply to someone we meet, there is a not-so-subconscious part of us that chooses immediately to resent this maybe saintly person. A faultless speaker also denies our complicity in the tremendously complex difficulties we observe. Being led through the world by someone faultless makes the world easy, and it makes any inevitably victimized then surmises about the world easy. Mari's speakers are all certain of the fact that, if nothing else, the world is not easy, and they are guiltily certain they've worked to make the world difficult. And yet, the real life Mari we know does not work to make the world difficult. She carries with her that particular and immediately identifiable warmth that seems innate in some people. And I've seen Mari use that warmth more times than I've thought to count, to pacify the difficulties of others, to help them as best as she is able. There's this, too, in her poem speakers, a tension between a pacifying warmth and a burdensome, guilty complicity. Mari's poems take us through the often bizarre undersurface of the rural American South. The poems are concerned with what it means to be raised in the South, to be made to confront the often idle and cruel epistemologies handed down to us casually, and to decide how to survive them. These poems are about this confrontation. They are about survival. The speakers name with a directness, sometimes with an ashamed directness, the hatreds and violences they've seen and experienced and performed. They speak for the dirty and the desolated. They speak for themselves. And they speak for the divine, which is, in Mari's poetry, something inside the self, something preserved, and something whose preservation makes it divine and signals to these speakers their own successful survivals. And yet, there's a way in which survival also signifies to these speakers the sense of complicity I originally spoke to, which is their difficulty. They feel stuck. And if they aren't stuck, they are haunted. But these speakers aren't without a kind of hope, which I think is Mari's warmth in them. Certain as they may be that the world isn't easy, they're equally certain the world is healing. They're certain they are healing. And that's the teaching of Mari's poems, I think. They're about a particular kind of humanness, a humanness that, in the poems you'll hear tonight, is about complicity. It's about healing with the difficult world that heals around her. Mari Carter is originally from Winona, Mississippi. Her poems have appeared in such places as Superstition Review, Salt Hill Journal, and Sundog Lit. She is currently pursuing a PhD in Lit at Florida State University, where she serves as poetry editor for the Southeast Review. Let's please welcome this beautiful poet and person to the stage.
Thank you. Yes, I'm already crying. Sorry. That was beautiful, Jamie. Thank you so much for that just thoughtful and extremely generous interpretation of my work. I'm excited to be here. Thank you all for being here. I know that we were competing with Alabama Shakes, so the fact that you're even here, I'm like, hell yeah. Also, thank you to Matt and Whitney. Y'all do such a great job and, you know, keep the ship going. And also to Alex Quinlan, who I have the honor of reading with tonight. I love you, brother. Can't wait to see what you do later. All right, I'm not going to talk too much. I'm just going to read some poems. This first one is called Spin the Bottle. In the beginning was the gritty tune of glass on concrete as the bottle slowed to a stop. Heat of his hand in mine as I followed him to a garage across the funeral home parking lot, where I was backed against a hearse and his whole self leaned into me. So that, years later, came the unbuttoning of shirts, collarbone licked in the stained glass shadows of a church office, and why once, when a boy asked, "Do you pray with that mouth?" as I clenched his nipple between my teeth and tongue ring, I said, "What do you think I'm doing?" For as long as I can remember, bodies were a way to beg forgiveness from desire's oblivion. Sex, the kind of worship I thought made me a true believer. Because what was the soft fog of that boy's breath, if not the first miracle to wet my lips? Even now, when I say his name, it's like a second coming in the blood, a divine acrystallization as the prism cross hung from a rearview mirror, immaculate as the first word Adam spoke into the world. And what is that if not deliverance? His mouth, irreducible, the beginning to all possible meaning. Whew, nerves. Sorry for any shakiness. It usually takes one or two to calm myself down because I get extremely nervous. All right, for this next one, it's called For My Cousin, the Stripper. When your parents went on Oprah, the whole family recorded it, used it to downplay the measure of their own rehab stints, stolen checkbooks, and Aunt Libby's affair with the mayor. At least I didn't knock up my stepdaughter, they'd say, which is what your father did, which is one thing you are. So no wonder you were born with restless knees, the kind that landed you in the laps of men with muscles so tender they nearly fell off the bone at the tees of your ass. You learned too early the currencies of tits and clit piercings, and in time, the past smoothed out like a crumpled 20 at the end of a long night. So when the girls you worked with jumped you for stealing customers, fractured an eye socket and broke three of your ribs, I didn't visit you in the hospital. I had no basis for questioning the strobe-lit club of their reasons. I don't know how to write a poem and make you the hero, easing past the heavy door of our soldered history, because you understand in your flesh what I only know in thought. Destiny is just the name of the girl at the vanity next to you, who says, "You gotta hand wash it, baby. Best way to get jizz out of lace." All right, now that we've kind of gotten a little past the crass point of the evening, this next one is called True Stomach, and it's about a field trip I took when I was in fifth grade. True Stomach. We need only be given permission, and a line is formed. Students begin hedging to the front where the cow, Peaches, they call her, stands waiting. A boy from another school pops the Doritos bag he's emptied and filled with his eager breath. But still, Peaches looks ahead, keeps chewing. The evidence visible through a hole in her stomach, held open by a clear plastic cone. A latex glove is slipped on, and I move forward, ready to enter where I shouldn't be allowed to enter without consequence. Inside, the mound of sodden cud rises with each breath. "Go on," a teacher prods. "Stick your hand in if you want." right. This next one is called What Else Is There to Say? What else is there to say? It's true, Shelley, that I held the lighter used to heat loose change we pinged off your naked arms and legs as you walked pigeon-toed down our high school hallways, your great sin being that you were touched by difference we couldn't put a name to. For years, there were no repercussions. Boys gripped me like I was a pulpit, and girls slipped me their secrets, even when I poised them over their heads like anvils in a Sunday morning cartoon. Maybe this all seems far away to you now, far from the blue blanket the nurses swallowed your stillborn in last July, a name that never slammed the back door or ran bases at the recreation park. Shelley, if anyone was owed the purest form of love, it was you. Because in the world you deserve, streets would be beset by rocking horses. Baby powder would waft through every air vent. A boy would trace the creases in the bend of your arm, unmarked by coins, those red whelps that only grew more pronounced throughout the day. Shelley, lately, people tell me I'm a good person, but each morning I have to remind myself to empty my pockets before leaving the house. So as I'm sure most of you have had this experience, you go back and you watch a lot of the films or television shows that you watched as a child, and with the new lens and sort of the new availability of discourse and new ways of talking about things, you inevitably see the problematic issues in a lot of those films. This happened one night. I was watching Dumbo, and so I wrote this poem. When I see an elephant fly, here is the lesson. Black feathers are magic. As blue-eyed Dumbo soars above spent tan bark at the last second, you think, hero. Wait, no. The feather is incidental. It was already in the elephant to fly. Admitting advantage is only the beginning. You see an elephant fly and you think special, because you always are in stories you tell about yourself. But a crow is a crow. Your wide world face knows this. You will continue to believe in the likelihood of applause. Let's see. All right, we're doing pretty good on time, yeah? I feel like I'm going pretty fast. Yeah. So this next one, pretty straightforward narrative. It was a hard one to write. I've been writing it for probably about 3 or 4 years, and it's gone through different manifestations, and I tried to editorialize a lot and downplay my own role in a situation. And I think at the end of the day, it is what it is, and we'll see. Winona, Mississippi, 2002. A few of us stood in the school parking lot the next day, hashing out the details of what had happened. They had been driving on a back road outside Vaden when the truck pulled ahead and cornered them in. Guns were jammed into their backs as they were forced onto their stomachs, onto the gravel. Clint was made to take his shoes off, throw them into a patch of Johnson grass. One man led Heather by the ponytail to the car, yelled at her to start the engine. Stephanie had cried when the cops asked if she managed to get a tag number. Hours later, the car was found still running on the side of the interstate, Heather in a ball on the backseat floorboard. Someone bragged that Brandon, hearing his cousin had been raped, bribed the other officers to give him 5 minutes in the cell. I told them when I skipped lunch to check on Heather. She smiled at me through the Valium. Then someone said, at least she'd had sex with a black guy before. And I, and everyone else, nodded. I think there's always that temptation to make yourself better than you actually are. And I hope I tried to resist that a little bit. This next one, and the final one, I feel like I've ran through and I haven't kept y'all too long. My friends Tyler and Tara recently had a baby, and they live in Colorado Springs, and I couldn't go to the baby shower. So instead, I wrote this poem. So on hearing you have been born for Julep, I hope the first person you kiss has a smile full of wire and hands that climb you like you're a jungle gym. Because, sweet girl, there's a part of yourself you won't know is illusion until you've picked all the four-leaf clovers from the playground, erased every lover's name you've scrawled onto bathroom stalls. Listen, our skin cells are constantly exhuming themselves, which means you will live a lifetime of small resurrections. If you're lucky, people will love you. But understand, there will always be something of you they'll never touch, which doesn't mean you shouldn't let them try. Often, it will be the only thing that reminds you you're here. Thank you.
Yeah, let's have one more round of applause for Mari Carter.
So next we're going to have Aaron Hoover introducing Alex Quinlan.
Poets have been writing defenses, at least since Plato challenged lovers of poetry to prove there could be a use in it as well as a delight. Writers across centuries have endeavored to answer Plato, from Aristotle to Sidney to Coleridge to Ezra Pound. I'm often struck by how similar the lines of inquiry are. What is poetry's purpose? How can this purpose best be accomplished? Who should write poetry, under what conditions, and who should read it? Even clickbait diatribes about the many nefarious ways that MFA programs are destroying poetry engage with the same set of questions. I don't mind that poets keep arguing about the same stuff. I read every one of those articles about MFA programs. But there's one critical distinction that emerged in the last century that I don't find useful. I'm talking about the binary between the head and heart, represented by the schism between T.S. Eliot and William Carlos Williams. The terms of this argument often have to do with accessibility. It seems that only one organ can be engaged to write a poem or to read it. A poem can either stand up to intellectual examination or it can move us. Alex Quinlan is here to tell you that this binary is false. If good poetry demonstrates the mind at work, Alex's poetry is exceptional in showing us the scaffolding, in inviting us to think along with him. He is fond of complex and compound sentence constructions and of drawing out the tension between the syntax of the sentence and the meter of the line. His references are many: the Epicurean philosopher Lucretius, the Panopticon, the tropes of metaphysical poets, Narcotics Anonymous, and notably Sidney's own defense of poesy. But if good poetry is also the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, Alex's poetry is exceptional in tuning a scene's emotional register so carefully that we can't help but feel along with him. He somehow manages to tell a story with restraint and abandon all at the same time. This might not make sense to you, but bear with me. It will in a few minutes. His lines proceed like everything's fine, artful and controlled, until the last line when it's not. Whatever darkness or mystery Alex reveals by the end was there the whole time, encoded in his images. For lovers of rhetoric, these poems are rhetorical. For lovers of lyricism, these poems are lyrical. I think T.S. Eliot and William Carlos Williams would both like Alex Quinlan. I also think that no one is going to be able to categorize Alex's book when it comes out, but that it will find readers who are struck by the work immediately, but also enjoy looking at a text over and over again, pulling something new from it each time. I've known Alex for over 3 years now as a friend and colleague in workshop and through our work together at the Southeast Review. I consider myself fortunate because I learn something new from Alex every time I talk to him. I mean about our mutual field of study, but also about believing in the best in people, including myself. As editors, he and I have argued over the most arcane rules of grammar and discovered the finer points of Microsoft Excel in a tiny windowless room in the Williams Building. In that room and on smoky porches, we've gotten into our aspirations for poetry, not necessarily our own poetry, but poetry as it's being written now in the world, developing provisional answers to some of the questions I brought up earlier. What is poetry's purpose? How can this purpose best be accomplished? Who should write poetry under what conditions, and who should read it? It's about time for you to hear the poems, but first, more about the man. Alex Quinlan's poems and nonfiction have appeared in Bat City Review, Beloit Poetry Journal, Oh No, Pebble Lake Review, Tampa Review, among others, as well as in the Tusculum Review, where he has been a contributing editor. He has also performed his poetry as part of Savannah, Georgia-based artist Jerome Meadows' Words and Shadows series. As I've mentioned before, Alex is the editor of the Southeast Review, my old job, as the comedians say. And we're lucky to have him here at FSU with us as a PhD student in poetry and the best damn musician a pickup band could ask for. Please join me in welcoming Alex Quinlan.
All right. Thank you so much, Aaron. I hope one day to grow up and fulfill all of that praise that as yet is wholly undeserved but welcomed. Aaron, on the other hand, cannot be praised enough. And if you happen to be in New York City tomorrow, Aaron will be reading where? Yeah, on Thursday. So you have an extra day to get there. But if you're at the New School, if you're in the vicinity of the New School on Thursday, you should drop in and watch as Aaron reads to the rapt audience there from the Best American Poetry Anthology, where her poem appears. Yeah. Now you're wishing that she just stayed up here, right? Me too. All right. Thank you, Whitney and Matt, for being wonderful hosts. Matt gave me this tarot card as a charm, and you wouldn't believe how apt it is. We'll come back to it in a minute. But I've got a few poems here to read. I'm going to sort of warm you and me up, mostly me, with some short ones. A little kind of epigrammatic fragment, and then a few sonnets, and then I'll bust into something a little bit more lengthy, and we'll see where it goes from there. My books. Sometimes I look at them and wonder why I don't toss them out in the street, these mute companions who only ever helped me vanish into other worlds. But then I remember myself and all the times they helped me vanish into other worlds. The filthy girl in the Kmart sundress. Her name was Beth, and over by the monkey bars, she said that I was her boyfriend now. Not that I knew what it meant, but it lifted me nonetheless. When we played Life after nap time one day, I landed on Get Married, so I grabbed a blue pin wife to match my blue pin self and the little blue car I slid around the board in. But the teacher said I needed pink. When I swapped them out, Beth said, "That's me." At recess, she kissed my mouth by the sandbox, grabbed my wrist, and yanked me back behind the shed where I once showed a bunch of boys my dad's smuggled pocket knife. "It's a game," she said, pulling down my shorts. "My daddy taught me." my mother. Oh, are you there? There? Hello? Fun. Fun. All right. Let's see if it holds. Nope. Okay. It wants to be kind of pulled over like this. It's a happy chord mostly, but fidgety and very particular. All right. So this one's called My Mother's Letters, and that's called a motorcycle. Mornings, those years between the dream fading and the nightmare coming on. After she dropped us at school, my mother sat on the sun porch of our creaky bungalow, smoking cigarettes, draining silver cans of Diet Coke, and composing letters to my father while he sweated in a warehouse for minimum wage, plus the proceeds on whatever he could steal. Her limpid script scrawled across page after page, but mostly she burned them in the backyard grill without showing them to anyone. Once I found one, still smoldering, the top page preserved as an ashen afterimage glowing at the edges. The text, "I was raped. I could read until I breathed." Rolling Thunder. August and me insane glean brown and green glass bottles buried deep in cricket grass, lob them into the alley behind the paintless gray wood A-frame carapace his mom and my dad have gone inside. We can hear them between the bleats, like an orphan billy goat caught in the rain of a car alarm down the street at Mr. Z's speaker world. We guess by the bumping and heaving that they are moving furniture. I kick a rock and it rings against a hurricane fence post. Sane says his mom didn't have a last name before she came to this place. I say, let's spy through the open fly of the kitchen curtain. But Sane's afraid of his mom's boyfriend, and I can't tell what it is behind his eyes that shatters when I say, I thought it was just my dad in there. This one takes a slightly different tenor on the same theme. And it takes for its point of culmination, or I guess arrival, the myth of, it's this sort of founding myth of democracy that in the midst of a famine, the last king and queen of Athens gave their bodies up to the citizens so that they could survive as something to sustain them, right? Kind of takes a version of that myth and runs with it. It's called Do You Remember? Do you remember the catalpa sticking out 1,000 orchid tongues by the branch where the slick bodies of the German trout water shimmer, the timothy knee-high and the sky any way you want it, where in the middle of a steep climb we panted, whoa, but we weren't holding horses, no. So past oral, we went all the way down instead to the damp mouth of the slate cave where the spring swells out of living mud and a darkness so total, living in it long enough makes the fish forget why they grew eyes in the first place. And there, where the wet of our breathing was the only heat in the dripping rock room, we echoed in each other's spit and like the last king and queen of Athens, offered our bodies up for the common good. All right, and here's a somewhat longer one. Maybe give you a sense of some of the experiments with syntax and making obscure references and stuff that Aaron talked about in the introduction to be true to it. So buckle up. It's called Imago, and I would explain it, but the poem explains it. So just keep in mind that the poem is called Imago, and I have many people in this room to thank for help on this poem, including Mari Carter, Zach Strait, Taylor Collier, Jake Kelly, who's not here, and anyone who was at the salon, Sindhu's salon this weekend, where I read a different version of this poem. So thank you all. Imago. All I know from those few dozen months, rolled like frozen hay on the pale level plain. Days I wandered strip mall parking lots, nosing my sedan like a manatee past the lampposts just turning on, in search of a grocery store, milk, eggs, something more. Years when snow still droned from the TV if I fell asleep during the movie and the tape played past the end. When the sleep that did come gave me no rest. All I know is I could never find what I was looking for, and that I most wanted the brush fires in their fingers that made my neighbors stalk and swipe at each other all night like feral cats, fucking mad and made wilder by the tameness they came from and killed. Their yowls candled the brick dark, rattled the wall's clay scales like a boxer's teeth when he catches a right cross flush. Until the only places where their shattering voices couldn't scrape were the high corners where the moths wore death masks and bred a silence cold as winter tin. A miracle they didn't sleep longer. And though they'd jab each other with glances, kissed like fists by six, in those uncurtained hours under the truce of sleep, they drifted into another orbit, basking in the tide of a repose neither remembered, but both remembered having had. A moth light that stitched them together where the wings go. And they can't help it, they hurt. Though sometimes I wish they wouldn't lay it on each other so heavy. Wish they would praise the simple fact that even if all they're doing is biding time until they drown in the photosonic ocean of a dying star, and they are, at least they can give each other a little pulse of gravity to cleave to or through, if that's what they wanted. And I couldn't have blamed them if they did, couldn't have said which was which from my distance anyway. Either way, they were making something true just by saying it. Like the prophets, like Jesus, who really was a charming bastard, you know? This son of no man who on the outskirts of Bethsaida unlocked the mystery of the potluck and fed 5,000. Everyone brings a little something, and before you know, the baskets overflow, the tables groan, and afterward, the fridge door won't close right for a couple days. This is when I invite the in-laws, and listen as my nephew tells me that these long-necked birds hunting the estuary at the coming and going of the light are all we have left of the dinosaurs. And there is a moth that lives 10 years in its chrysalis, longer than he's been alive, before it emerges, bearing tasseled horns and an orchid tattoo across its wings. And did I know the mature moth is called an imago? And I'm thinking in psychology, it's the word for the idealized mental image of someone you try to shape yourself to, something to follow when you get lost. And he says, it mates and dies within a week, never even eats. Which is just the sort of thing I'd tell my uncle at dinner when I was his age. And the whole time, I'm looking at his dad, then back at him, sizing up the two of them side by side, trying to slide between them all the changes between them, and thinking of how Ovid starts out. My mind leaves me to speak now of forms changed into new bodies. And before long, the hunter has sprouted antlers, and his hounds have ripped him stitch from seam. The river girl who sewed herself into a notch in the laurel tree gives way to a bull-headed bastard locked up in a maze, and his half-sister who betrays her city's secrets with a skein of thread to help the handsome stranger find his way. And when he does, he just leaves. Which is pretty much what I do when I get lost. Pick someone who seems to know where they're going and follow them until I see something I recognize or don't. Then swerve like Lucretius believed atoms do, skidding between random births in the void, giving birth to all meaning, nothing more than pattern and variation. For example, the rhythm at night and the low oaks above the sand-choked creek when the peacocks rattle and shriek. I wonder if their eggs shimmer the way their feathers do, if they started wild or, like pigeons, descend from escaped pets, or if there's even a point in getting the story from the egg, ab ovo, as they say, the beginning, which is usually way more boring than cutting to the chase. People love the chase. People love the chase so much that there are whole movies that are nothing but chase. And yet, the beginning, where it all came from, where everything first went wrong or didn't, that's what startles me from sleep at night, like the thief's footfall and the leaf litter beneath the bedroom window. And what Lucretius believed sounds neat and scientific, even though it was really just a blind guess that happened to be right, more or less. Better anyway than the Macedonian driftwood the Catholic Church used to patch the leaky hull of its celestial lifeboat, which they steered by the stars, so they had to put themselves at the origin, coordinates 00. Moths navigate by the moon, so streetlights make them fly lunatic circles, and they have what feels like a fine dust covering their wings, though it's really a microscopic lace of scales made of crooked hairs, each enclosing a cell of air, which is to say they're mostly nothing. But this is where the dust gets stirred up and the atoms cross contrails, swirl like the cratered moons orbiting the moth that swallowed the world and all the stars in the beginning. This is where, having spelled down to each synaptic root's branching the brain state that equals belief, the stars swarm into another chance shape. And this is where the new breed of primitive, bastard child of a grocery store egg and the haywire geneticist who unteaches it evolution ab ovo, cancels the code that tells wing to form from three-fingered claw, tail to spin back into spine, pecks a hole in its pale shell, emerges into the incubator's electric heat, and resembles nothing so much as a palm-sized velociraptor. This is where the old home video, the one with the go-kart crash, the moonwalk on roller skates, the number one song all summer long playing in the background, and the kid, at first I'm not sure who, but then I see, it's me. Astride a bike two sizes too big, and just as I put my feet on the pedals and lurch forward, the frame fills with snow, forgetting what my skin knows. And this is where I prove I'm not following you. Just finding my way through the new traffic pattern. Just wait till this light turns. Just wait, I say to myself. Pretty soon, everything's gonna change. Y'all are too sweet. And so, knowing I was going to read this poem tonight, it was poignant to pull the ace of spades. I guess is there a better thing to call this? Okay, I don't know what this is, but it provides me protection from being led astray, right? Which is kind of nice and in a poem where the speaker just gets lost over and over and over again. But one of the ways that I find myself is by coming back again to this wonderful community we have here. And one of the things that makes it so great is that we're always challenging each other. And when I saw Matt here last week and said, oh, I'm so excited to be on the stage next week, and thank you and Whitney for being such wonderful hosts. And he said, well, you know what you should do if you want to actually thank me? And I said, oh, shit, what? And he said, well, you and Mari should write a poem together. And I've never done that before, and neither had Mari. But what the hell? We went ahead and did it for love of you all. So, Mari, you want to come up here and help me with this thing?
like John.
Yeah, how about it? All right, so we'll do our best sharing this microphone. I don't know if we'll do our best Johnny and June, right?
Oh, I got on.
Okay. We could go on like this for some time.
So we do.
I made this for you.
So you can't say I never gave you nothing.
It's everything I ever wanted.
And nothing I needed.
It's the first ride in a used car.
First red lipstick stole from JCPenney's.
The house rule you like so much you broke it right away.
No strangers allowed.
Because you give yourself
so little room.
You have to watch your elbows around the small child at your heels.
Avoid narrow hallways and low door frames.
It's better when we're here and we're not here.
Then we don't have to pretend our way into picture frames.
It's better when the frames are empty.
Because emptiness is its own argument.
And a mirror is a landscape.
A field in which we are gathering to watch hay bales set on fire.
To stop the spread of an invasive beetle with iridescent wings.
We tell ourselves this is a thing we can control.
Because we made it in the first place.
But I'm tired of standing stubble and shin deep, choking.
So come in under the porch where it's cool and the ceiling fan wobbles the air and the pitch of the guitar strings
is not an antecedent to ruin.
Because the ruins are all around us already.
I've been thinking how I will go the way of older memorials.
As we all do, sooner or later. So why rush it?
This town is full of what we are trying to forget.
What are you trying to pretend you don't know?
For so long, I have been writing a mythology nobody asked for.
I started with ash from the bale fire, made gunpowder and packed it into fireworks that spelled dragons across the mountain ridge and the names of the dread gods it dismantled by time.
Gods whose names our tongues no longer believe in.
Then I added the cream and sugar and hoped it was how you liked it.
Because ritual is all that's left to us now.
All we ever had. The only thing we haven't lost is the feeling something's been lost.
So we keep turning over the couch cushions, checking under the bed.
For a door to another dimension, or at least a little gas money.
A little shelter, the lie we tell ourselves.
And when we tell it to each other, we make it come true.
In this version, you're waking up, and the sun is in its feverish ambition has already risen.
On a page of Frank Lloyd Wright, where he says he had to choose between the honest arrogance and hypocritical humility. The burden of genius, I'm spared.
Because no one has ever asked me to be the architect of their happiness.
But I went ahead and signed up anyway. Took a couple woodworking classes. Left little lathe-turned waterfowl all over the house.
And when the time came, I held the match while you stood on the porch and kept your hands clean.
And I ran a basin of warm water and washed your feet when you came back in.
We could go on like this for some time.
So we do.
Let's thank them again, yeah.
I love it when people listen to me. That was beautiful. Thank you, Alex and Mari. Thank you all for coming. If you could kindly bus your bottles and wine glasses and beer glasses back to the bar, that would help us out. And Whitney, who do we have next week?
Next week, please come back at 8 p.m. for Kate Kimball and Jamie Ringleb. Thank you, guys.